This is KNX In Depth, an hour each day when we dig deeper, ask more questions, tell you how the major stories of the day impact you. I'm Mike Simpson, along with Charles Feldman.
If President Trump ever wants to host another reality TV show, it might be called The Walk Back. Yesterday, he had to walk back comments he made alongside Russia's president. Later, via Twitter, he seemed to be walking back that walk back this morning at a cabinet meeting. Some present think he denied ongoing Russian meddling in our affairs, but that was walked back a few hours later by his press secretary. And so the great debate is on. What did the president say? What did the president really mean? And did the president even really say it? We will go in depth. Also, why you may not want to wear those sunglasses. And yes, I know it's raining. And yes, I know it's Southern California.
Walk back or not, former Homeland Security cyber expert weighs in on how we, the president, or even in the intelligence community, can be sure about what the Russians may be up to. And think twice before writing a nasty online review of your doctor. You may find yourself on the other end of a lawsuit. That'll make your blood pressure rise. Also, simple blood tests may soon be able to spot a potentially dangerous cancer just in the nick of time.
The White House now denies that Mr. Trump said no when a reporter asked if the president of Russia was still targeting the U.S. White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders spoke just a short time ago.
The president said thank you very much and was saying no to answering questions. The president and his administration are working very hard to make sure that Russia is unable to meddle in our elections, as they have done in the past and as we have stated.
So is that what happened? Well, here's the bite. You decide.
Is Russia still targeting the U.S.,
Mr.
President?
Thank
Correct.
You
Let's go. Make your way out. No, you don't think that's the case? Let's go.
Joining us now is Paul Rosenzweig. He is the former Deputy Assistant of Policy at the U.S. Department for Homeland Security. He's also a senior fellow with the R Street Institute, which specializes in issues relating to privacy and cybersecurity. Thank you for joining us. So I guess the question for you is whether the president said yes or no or maybe or didn't even say it. How can we tell? How can anyone tell whether or not the Russians are still targeting this country and this country's electoral process?
Well, the answer to that's pretty simple. We can tell from the forensic evidence that demonstrates that they are. We had a good sample of that in Special Counsel Mueller's indictment last Friday, which was page after page of detailed cyber forensic evidence, which is essentially, electronic fingerprint, if you will, that tied Russian interference directly to efforts to infiltrate American electoral systems. We can see similar signatures happening today. Just the other week, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, said that the warning lights are blinking red for Russian infiltration. So we know that it's happening, and whether the president wants to acknowledge that or not is really his problem.
What do blinking red lights mean to you? Does that mean it's ramping up again, or it's near constant probing? I mean, what do you see when you hear Dan Coats say that?
Well, when Coats says something like that, I think that the measure of vulnerability is the degree of probing and the degree of success in that probing. It's probably the case, and I think that Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen said this the other day as well, that there's likely a little bit less of an effort this time around because midterms are typically less important than presidential elections. So we haven't seen as much, and in addition, we're a little more aware, so we're being much better at the defensive work that's ongoing. But blinking red means it's not quite bright red, full stop red, but it is a massive warning sign that efforts are underway both to infiltrate the electoral infrastructure and also, frankly, to undermine our confidence in the integrity of the elections. It almost doesn't matter if it's successful. If we doubt that that the elections are secure, we doubt the result even if they're unsuccessful.
You know, we had somebody on the other day, an expert academic, who was pointing out that in various times in this country's history, our intelligence community got it wrong about many things, aspects of the Vietnam War. They certainly got wrong that Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction as a justification for going into Iraq. And his point was, so how can you really rely on our intelligence communities? Because they're fallible.
Well, of course they're fallible. How can you rely on anybody saying anything? How can we rely on the news? How can we rely on our doctor? How can we rely on our plumber? They all make mistakes. The question is the degree of to which they make the mistakes and the degree to which they share the underlying information that justifies their decision making. If we look, for example, at the details in Robert Mueller's 29-page indictment from last week, that's 29 pages of detail that can be cross-checked by anybody who wants to see whether or not this particular allegation is accurate or not. And perhaps it'll prove not to be. I see no reason to think that in this case, though.
It's Paul Rosenzweig, former Deputy Assistant of Policy, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, now Senior Fellow with the R Street Institute.
As always, you can hear a repeat of this program at 8 o'clock tonight, the podcast on our website, knx1070.com or the radio.com app. When KNX In-Depth continues in about 4 minutes, we'll talk with former White House counsel for Richard Nixon, John Dean. You're listening to KNX In-Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
Reminder, after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, be careful what you write about your doctor online, maybe Yelp. You might get sued.
Right now, back to the latest round of turmoil in the White House. Yesterday, the president walked back his comments in Helsinki about Russia's meddling in the U.S. presidential election. Today, he is walking back that walk back. Then he said something this morning, as we pointed out, and now the White House is walking that back. John Dean was White House counsel under President Richard Nixon. John, you're a veteran of, shall we say, Oval Office intrigue, and welcome back, by the way, to the program. What is going on, do you think, in the White House now?
I was just listening to the number of walkbacks you were recounting, and it seems to me he's going in a circle backwards. That's something that Richard Nixon did not do. I can't recall many walkbacks, if any, during his time, because he tried to think before he spoke. Anyway, it's clear that Trump reacted to the very negative reaction he got to the interview or the press conference in Helsinki, when members of his own party and just pretty much people across the board in the media, right and left, thought he was way off base in attacking America's intelligence agencies, standing next to a former KGB officer who now happens to be a thug who leads a country.
Yeah, you know, usually we get these White House in chaos stories. There's been plenty of those. Now we have after this, we have the John Kelly story going around telling the lawmakers, please go and criticize the president, at least according to Vanity Fair, saying he needs to know how bad of a mistake this was. Which is worse?
Well, I don't know how much longer Kelly's going to last as chief of staff, but that's probably being a fairly responsible chief of staff. Trying to get, knowing that he has expended all of his chips with the president and has little influence with him, to get him to sort of rally the troops that people Trump might listen to. It's really an odd situation. You've got a president who really knows he knows nothing about the job. He doesn't read history. He doesn't read briefing books. And yet he doesn't want to be told when he makes mistakes. So the chief of staff has to have, do it through a circuitous route and get it done. So, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It just shows how dysfunctional this White House is.
But I'm imagining, and if I'm wrong, then just please say so. But in the time that you were in the White House, right, I mean, there must have been times in the Oval Office when maybe you or somebody else walked into to President Nixon and said, what, Mr. President, what you said is wrong, or your position is not one that's going to go over well, you need to say this. Does that kind of conversation go on, and how comfortable is it for the people engaged in that kind of conversation?
Well, I had a fairly famous conversation with Mr. Nixon about Watergate and his cover-up, telling him there was a cancer on his presidency. That was about as blunt as I knew how to be, and then confront him with every single problem I could think of to try to get him to smack his fist down on his desk and say, it's got to stop. I failed. He wanted the cover-up to go on. But anyway, I think most presidents, they appreciate when a staff calls to their attention something that is particularly egregious or deadly wrong or whatever. And I would think, you know, I think any leader does. Any businessman, he wants to know if he's making a mistake, and that's what you have staff for in many instances, to make sure you get it right.
You think sometimes staffers get a bit overwhelmed, though? I mean, you can imagine walking into that room. It's the Oval Office. Here's the president. He's at that desk, and you're trying to tell him he's wrong. You might back down before you get halfway through.
This president will not tolerate it. He does not want to be told he's wrong. All he wants to be told is how great he is and how good he is, and to sort of stroke his ego even more every day. He apparently thrives on it, needs it, and his staff's afraid to do it. So it's a really horrible situation. You add that to his lack of experience. You know, here he was dealing with a man who's been a head of state for 18 years. 18 years. And he has 18 months in a job he doesn't have any idea of how it functions. So, you know, he was dealing with somebody who was so out of his area, which is selling condos, the fact that he didn't rely heavily on staff, the fact that he would risk a one-on-one meeting with Putin is, and we have other than the translator.
So let me ask you this, John, because you've written a number of books. If you were writing as your next book, John Dean's Guide to Interpreting the Trump White House, what would you say in your opening paragraph or opening chapter on how the public is to interpret what comes out of this White House?
Well, it's become increasingly clear that you have to at least wait 48 hours for anything that comes out of this man's mouth to know if he's going to reverse course, walk it back. And we'd have an ongoing record of his false statements that have reached the, you know, astronomical numbers. There are people who are literally a number of organizations, newspapers, scholarly people who are charting them. And apparently in the last 2 months, they have spiked to unusually high percentages of his statements are just flat out lies.
You know, if you write that book, it'll probably be a bestseller.
Giving him ideas. All right. John Dean, White House counsel under Nixon.
A reminder, you can hear a repeat of this program 8 o'clock tonight. The podcast on our website, knx1070.com, or for free, absolutely free, download the radio.com app. When KNX In-Depth continues in about 4 minutes, is President Trump losing fans at Fox?
You're listening to KNX In Depth, along with Charles Feldman. I'm Mike Simpson.
And a reminder, after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking about why it might be better for your eyes to take off those sunglasses.
Right now, though, is President Trump losing Fox?
I'll give the benefit of the doubt to maybe jet lag and time differences, but holy tamale.
And Neil Cavuto, not the only one at Fox who criticized the president's performance in Helsinki. Holy tamale. Joining us now, Al Tompkins, expert on the media with the Poynter Institute. So let's take the words right out of Cavuto's mouth, though. If you lose Fox, holy tamale.
Yeah, well, I suppose. I don't think there's any real danger that he's losing Fox, at least not some of the shows. Now, to be fair, Fox hasn't always marched completely in line politically. I mean, Shepard Smith, as an example, is, I think, pretty even-handed, and Britt Hume has been, and Chris Wallace has been, and so on. So I don't think that is exactly happening. And I will also say that the Hannity, for example, who is certainly in Trump's camp, has gotten very strong ratings this week. And maybe it's just because people want to go, wow, I wonder what he's going to do now, and tuned in. But he's had big numbers this week.
So is he really, Sean Hannity, the sort of litmus test for all of this in the way that Walter Cronkite all those years ago, allegedly, and then it may or may not be apocryphal, when President Johnson said, if you lose Walter Cronkite talking about the Vietnam War, then that's it. Is the fact that if Sean Hannity comes out and says something that's negative about Trump, is that it then?
Yeah, I mean, that'd be pretty devastating. There's no doubt about that. And you would have to say, I mean, to make your point, you would have to say that Fox and Friends in the morning was critical of the president in ways that you typically haven't seen anybody on that show be. So, you know, your point is taken there. But, yeah, if Hannity ever turned on him and began being critical of him, that would be a big moment for the president. There's no doubt about that.
You know what I seem to notice was over on Fox Business, the sister network, they kind of broke first, those hosts, and then the regular net followed a little bit later.
Don't know if there's a. I don't know if that's if that's coincidental that something went first or not. I mean, businesses channels tend to analyze faster and react faster to things. I don't know that it's causation or correlation, but you're right. It took a while, but it did wash. And part of it was what just happened here. I mean, I don't know if it's just me, but these last few days, I've seen and heard things, and you step back and say, wait, did I just hear that? I mean, is that really what happened? And it takes you a while almost to consume it and figure out what happened.
Well, you know, we've been talking, you know, for the first part of this program about all these walkbacks. The president says one thing, then the White House walks it back, then the president walks it back, then the president says something else, then he walks that back. Have you kept count?
No, I can't even imagine what the number would be. I don't even like the phrase "walk back." To be honest with you, I mean, in another era, we would have called it a flip flop.
Flip flop.
I think "walk back" might be a bit gentle here. Maybe we ought to call it an edit. That would be
an edit.
An edit.
But I mean, look, I mean, it is. If they change their mind or they change their story, and you really can't perfume that pig very much. I mean, it is a different version.
Okay. All right. Al Tompkins, expert on the media at the Poynter Institute.
You heard what he said. Can't perfume that pig.
Remember when we thought that like 2017 was busy and 2016 was busy?
Yeah. Well,
here we are.
2018. Can't wait for 2019. A reminder, you can hear a repeat of this program at 8 o'clock. You don't have to wait till 2019 for that, by the way, just 8 o'clock. And the podcast is on our website, knx1070.com, or download for free the radio.com app in 5 minutes or so when KNX In Depth continues. All right. So you had a really bad day, right? At the doctor. And maybe you're thinking about saying something critical on social media about the doctor. Wait.
You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
So we have all had our good and bad experiences with doctors, but if you have a notably negative one, you may want to think twice before you put it all over social media, because you could be sued.
So with us now is Professor Eric Goldman of Santa Clara University Law School. He's also the co-director of the High Tech Law Institute. So, Professor, is this becoming a real issue, a real problem, doctors suing patients?
It's a constant risk, something that we've known for a long time, and we don't see it every day, but when it happens, it's often a major moment in the defendant's life.
And are these Yelp reviews, are there doctor rating websites out there that people are posting to? Where is this, some of this getting started?
It starts with patient reviews, which can be put into a number of different review sites, Yelp among them, but there are a number of other ones. I don't think we've seen any lawsuits over ratings of doctors. So the ratings generally don't have enough stuff to be the source of a lawsuit, but the reviews can.
So if a patient says something negative about a doctor, and maybe they're right, or maybe they've made some stuff up because they're annoyed that they had to wait a half hour in the waiting room, why shouldn't a doctor be able to say, hey, look, what you wrote about me is defamatory, it's going to hurt my practice, in my view it's wrong, and I'm going to seek remedy in court? Why not?
Doctors can sue for defamation, just like anyone else in our society can. The challenges for doctors bringing defamation lawsuits, however, are pretty significant. So it isn't really a question just of whether the law allows them to bring the suit. It does. But whether it's a good idea for them to bring the lawsuit. And I'm going to say more about that, but I also just want to mention that we also see doctors who use the threat of a lawsuit to drive off negative reviews. So when we say that doctors should be able to enforce their rights, when they do so against a legitimate review, but just threaten to bring suit and drive it off the internet, we also lose something very valuable in that process.
Well, I think some people maybe who are posting these, they feel like this is their last resort, because maybe they've tried to talk to the doctor or the hospital, they've lodged their complaint, they get stuck in the bureaucracy, and now they go online to get something to happen.
Absolutely. There's a number of situations we've seen where patients have been able to use advocacy in order to improve their posture in their medical process. But a lot of times it's just people trying to help the rest of their peers by sharing their actual experiences. It's one of the best things about consumer reviews is that it allows us to talk to each other as consumers. And so I don't think we should think of all the reviews as being axes to grind. Many of them are just people talking. I will also add that 90% of reviews in some circumstances are positive. Most people are saying nice things about their doctor. They're not trying to bash the doctor.
But when a doctor or a hospital decides to sue a disgruntled patient, is it a level playing field?
It's a great question because doctors are subject to confidentiality restrictions, and our hospitals are too. They cannot reveal the information that's specific to a patient under the privacy law called HIPAA. So doctors have often felt that the playing field isn't level, that they can't go and defend themselves robustly because of the fact that they can't share all the information. In practice, that's really not a significant limitation. Most of the time, doctors have the ability to explain what they're doing without talking about a particular patient's particular case. And a lot of the complaints that patients are posting about aren't related to medical information at all. They are things like, I had to wait for the doctor for half an hour, or I couldn't find parking, or I had a problem with billing.
Does some of that go back to what you were saying a minute ago about maybe the doctors should think hard about whether they should proceed with a lawsuit?
They really should think very carefully about it because a bunch of bad things can happen if they bring a lawsuit. First of all, they'll draw more attention to the negative feedback, and it's called the Streisand effect, that actually trying to hide or suppress information can sometimes counterproductively cause more attention to be brought to it. But also doctors face things like the risk of a malpractice claim being brought by the patient who they sue or the patient going and filing a complaint with the medical board. And here in California, we have a statute called the anti-slap law that protects people who post consumer reviews. And in some cases, it would require the doctor who loses the case to write a check to the patient for having brought the lawsuit in the first place.
You know, to go back to what you're saying and what we were talking about, whether it was a level playing field when there's a lawsuit, and you were talking about from the doctor's point of view, they may feel hamstrung because they can't reveal certain information because of privacy laws and regulations. But isn't there another side to that coin, which is that often doctors and certainly hospitals have a lot of financial power behind them and stacked up against the sole patient? Isn't that an unfair fight?
Absolutely. And that's why, in fact, we see so many patients who are threatened with a lawsuit simply fold. They'll say, tell me what I need to do to avoid the lawsuit. You want me to delete or edit that review? I'll do whatever you want. Just tell me. Just don't sue me. And the fact that patients are so willing to fold actually emboldens people like doctors to make threats just to get the content changed or removed. So we as consumers of services often aren't willing to invest the money to stand behind our words, but the businesses we're reviewing are willing to throw a lot of money at trying to change our words.
That's Professor Eric Goldman, Santa Clara University Law School, co-director of the High Tech Law Institute.
Okay, now the sun isn't really out at the moment, but let's say it was.
Yeah,
right.
Pretend.
So let's pretend it's sunny.
Bright, beautiful day.
Just a glistening sun, right? So you reach for your sunglasses. Understandable. But maybe that's a really bad mistake. We'll explain when KNX In Depth continues.
You're listening to KNX In Depth. Mike Simpson along with Charles Feldman.
Okay, so if you thought it was better for your eyes to wear sunglasses, new research is saying just the opposite. Joining us is Dr. Ken Mitten, a researcher at the Oakland University Eye Research Institute. Welcome, doctor. So it seems sort of counterintuitive. If it's sunny, as it often is here in L.A., not today, but often is, you want to reach for your sunglasses. Not a good idea?
Well, it kind of depends on, I guess, the time of day a little bit, and also if you have a hat. Most of the light that we see, the visible light, that's what really kind of controls our pupil size. And, you know, when it's really bright, our pupils will close down, and that'll let a lot less light get into your lens, especially in your eye and wear and tear on that with aging. But the UV light, usually just the near UV called UVA, is kind of what we get from sunlight. And since that's really coming directly from the sun, and then especially where you are, you have that over your head a lot of sunny days, maybe not everywhere today in California, but most of the time. And so the UV light can actually sneak by and really, you know, if the sun is really up above your head and your glasses aren't directly blocking the sun from your eyes, you're looking ahead on the street, you're driving along the highway, your pupils open up because you've got your sunglasses on and you're kind of darkening it, so your pupils open up more. And that UV light, which really doesn't affect your pupil size, can really sneak in and get into your eye. So it's really a good idea to have a ball cap, good old ball cap. If I had a ball cap or sunglasses and I had to use one or the other, I'd use a ball cap to shade my eyes. And if you have both, that would be great. But definitely shading your eyes from wherever the sun is, you can't lose going with that option.
So now you have all of L.A. saying, I'm going to mess up my hair. I can't wear a hat.
Well, all right, and I guess all those hat designers out there, and that's part of style, too, got something they can maybe work with. So.
But does it matter what kind of sunglasses? I mean, you know, if you bought, I can hear some people.
Just get the good ones.
Yeah, I don't want to say anything, but like, I don't know, Beverly Hills, saying, oh, but if we bought $5,000 pair of sunglasses, that's going to be just fine.
Yeah, well, it turns out that, and somewhat being of a scientist in different areas and being in the eye, I kind of know about absorption and things like that as a chemist, too. It turns out that most plastics, even cheap ones, they kind of transmit light, okay? Obviously, we see through them until you sort of get to right where about UV starts. And a lot of regular plastics, even cheap sunglasses, expensive sunglasses, they absorb a lot of the near UV light quite effectively. And as a matter of fact, when we're measuring things in ultraviolet range in the lab, we often would use quartz cuvettes or very, very specialized plastics that let enough UV light through them for us to do absorption chemistry. So it turns out that a cheap pair of sunglasses is about as good as buying a prescription pair or even one that has extra UV coatings, because there's not that much more UV left to suck up. I mean, adding a coating probably takes another, you know, 0.5% of the 99% or so that's already absorbed by the plastic itself.
So you've got this new research. This is what you're saying now. How do you fight the, I don't know, decades of put on the sunglasses because it's going to protect your eye?
Well, you know, you do want to protect your eye. Protecting your eyes is a good thing to do. Your lens in your eye, for example, is one of the oldest places for protein in your body. Proteins in the middle of your lens in your eye were made when you were an embryo, you know, in your mom's belly. And those proteins have to last your entire life. And as our population is aging now, you know, we're starting to get up to close to 79 or so for the average life expectancy of men and women in the U.S., that it's like, you know, how long does your tire last on your car? And how long will that lens last? And so the more, you know, wear and tear it gets from having absorbing UV and light over time, you know, it might wear out sooner. You might get a cataract earlier. You might need to get an operation to get that lens removed and get an intraocular lens implant. So if you can reduce having to do that to yourself, you should probably take precautions to do that. Sunglasses are fine. It's you can get sunglasses that wrap right to touch to you. Some of the athletic ones, you see some of the bikers on some of the and some of the runners using, they wrap right tight to your head. So when the sun's overhead, they don't get, they're sort of getting shaded by that sunglass. So the thing is just to be aware of where the sun is. If you're out in the evening and the sun's pretty low and you can see the sun is through your sunglasses, then you're shading your eyes. So sunglasses can be good. You just need to kind of think logically about where is the sun, and if you're squinting in your sunglasses a little bit because the sun's directly overhead and you've got the top down and you're in the traffic jam there going home, it's probably good to shade your eyes.
There's your clue.
So if there were an aerial photograph of a beach with lots and lots of people sitting there with sunglasses, but one guy with no sunglasses and a hat, would that be you?
Oh, that should be me. That's right. That's right. And earlier in the summer, I got to take a vacation in Honolulu, and I got my Waikiki ball cap, from the ABC stores there, and I carry that with me because I tell people about the ball cap, so if they catch me walking around without my cap on, they'll let me know.
Okay. All right, Dr. Ken Mitten, researcher, Oakland University Eye Research Institute.
You go to the beach, you see somebody sitting there with a hat, it's the doctor.
It's Ken.
It's him. A reminder, you can hear a repeat of this program at 8 o'clock tonight when KNX In-Depth continues in just a few minutes. Some of the stories you may have missed, but we did not. You're listening to KNX In-Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
Scientists in Australia say they have a blood test that can detect potentially lethal skin cancers in their earliest stages before they spread. They say the test could be better than just looking at moles doing a biopsy. Study involved more than 200 people. Researchers say melanoma detected in early stages in more than 80% of cases. The test could be available for general use maybe 2-3 years.
Well, you know, you couldn't blame residents of Kent County, Michigan if they think they are seeing double. They are twin sisters running for two different county commissioner seats. Although voters may have a tough time figuring out which one is which by appearance, it is not the case when it comes to politics. One sister is running as a Democrat, the other is running as a Republican. The sisters say they do not fight about issues. However, they each also say they are loyal to their own political party.
Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Mike Simpson. Thanks for joining us here on KNX In-Depth. Reminder, In-Depth repeats at 8 o'clock tonight. You can hear the podcast. That's on the website, knx1070.com or on the radio.com app. More tomorrow at 1 p.m.